Hi, this is Allison Sheridan of the NoSillaCast podcast, hosted at podfeet.com. Today is Sunday, November 6th, 2005, and this is show number 15. Well, I gotta tell you, you guys must have friends everywhere. As soon as I said last week that we had no South or Central American listeners, I got visitors to podfeet.com from Colombia, Peru, and Panama. Welcome to our new listeners. This is just so exciting to have you guys here. This is fantastic. Did you guys call your friends in those areas and say, hey, let's see if we can get out a shout out on NoSillaCast? I hope so. That'd be really fun. We also picked up some folks from Singapore and just today, Slovenia. I'm so bad at geography, I had to look up Slovenia. My atlas is pretty old, so I was sitting there looking at Yugoslavia and saying, wait a minute, does Yugoslavia still exist? I'm not too clear on that stuff, so I had to call my friend Bill and get a geography lesson on the area. So welcome to all of our new listeners from all these countries. It's really exciting. Glad to have you here. Let's do an experiment. I want to see whether there's real feedback going on here. I'll pick a country, and you guys find someone from that country to listen. This week I pick Russia. I was going to say Zimbabwe. Well, actually, my son Kyle suggested Zimbabwe, but I thought that might be a little bit tough. So let's start with something, a place with relatively high volume, and maybe next week we can try something tough like Zimbabwe. So I expect to see some Russian participation on podfeet.com in the coming week. So this is the last podcast before the Podcast Expo. I hope I haven't built it up too much in my mind, but I'm so looking forward to it. I just can't wait to be hanging out with all these cool podcasters and learn how other people are doing stuff, get a chance to exchange ideas on this powerful new technology and where it can take us. Not just in entertainment, but what we can do with it in business is fascinating to me. I've never been on the leading edge of something before, and it's really, really exciting to get to do this. I'm going to do a podcast from the Expo, that's for sure, but I'm not sure if I'll be able to get out a show with show notes or not. Probably not, but I'll probably stay up half the night doing it, and then definitely a podcast on Sunday if I don't get one out during the actual show. I'm sure my enthusiasm level for the show will probably dictate or how late I stay up hanging out with all my new friends. So Ron and I will be at the Podcast Expo. Anybody out there who's listening and is actually going to be there, it'd be a great kick to get to meet you. So first I want to tell you about an iBook monitor resolution hack that I found. Remember last week I ranted about my awful experience with Samsung? By the way, still don't have my money back. It's almost 5 months now since I bought that Samsung monitor. Two Samsung monitors that never worked. But remember I ended up with a 19-inch HP LCD. The purpose was for my daughter to use it with her iBook as she went away to college. And imagine my chagrin when I hooked this up only to find out that the maximum resolution on the iBook is 1024 by 768. Now, it looks like Apple actually purposely puts in the firmware to cripple the resolution because the graphics card that they've got in there can certainly handle a higher resolution. But they've crippled it, and I thought, well, wait a minute, maybe there's a way to fix that. The other thing it can't do is it can't natively do spanning between two displays. That's where you have two different things on the two displays and they act like one huge monitor. You can actually drag your mouse from one monitor to the other and it acts like one big monitor. So the iBook can only do mirroring of the display where you have the same thing on both monitors. So my daughter looks at it and was just really bummed at how lame it looked and how it's like 19-inch. Why buy a 19-inch monitor? All it is the letters are bigger. So that was stupid. So I told her, just hang on. Let me see if I can find a way to fix it. I was immediately successful searching on the web. I just typed in iBook monitor hack or resolution hack, something like that, and I found a tool called Screen Spanning Doctor available at rootmoler.com. I've got the link in the show notes because it's pretty long, but this hack isn't for the faint of heart, but since I'll try anything, that's my theme, is I'll throw anything on any computer to see what it does, I installed this application and it worked like a charm. She can now do 1280 by 1024 on her iBook on the secondary screen, and she can span between the two screens, keeping so she can have all 26 of her separate AIM windows open at the same time. So I really recommend this Screen Spanning Doctor. He does have a big disclaimer there. If it screws something up, that's your problem. But so far, she's been running it for several months, and it works just great. This is probably an even more useful tip I'm going to give you here. I have the greatest spam fighting tool ever. You're not going to believe this, but I don't get any spam on my personal email account. Not any. I don't mean I have good filters that make me not have to see it. I mean I don't get any at all. The magic behind this is a service I use called SpamX from SpamX.com. SpamX gives you 500 disposable email addresses, all of which get routed back to your real address. Let me give you an example to explain how this works. Let's say I want to buy something from Amazon. I jump over to SpamX.com, put in my password, and then click on Create a New Address. I usually choose a name that tells me where I used it, like Amazon at SpamX.com. Once I've chosen a name, I cut and paste that name into the website where I'm shopping. So I go back over to Amazon.com, and where it asks for address, I say Amazon at Amazon.com. This whole process of jumping over to SpamX and back, getting in, sticking in a password, picking a new address, usually only takes about 1 minute, and now Amazon doesn't have my real address. The magic of picking an address like Amazon at SpamX.com is because I'll know who sells my address if I ever do get spam, because it won't come to my real address. It'll come to that address like Amazon at SpamX.com. The interesting thing is I don't get spam and then I'm able to turn it off. I don't get any spam at all. So what I'm guessing is that spammers don't buy addresses that end in SpamX.com. Why would you? Why would you pay for that? Because you know the person can get rid of it. The real beauty comes in when they do start sending junk to you. In my case, it's junk mail, I would say, not spam, because let's say someone like Amazon does want to send me other email just because they got a hold of my address. So what SpamX lets you do is selectively blacklist certain addresses. You probably want the email that comes from your order has shipped at SpamX, or I'm sorry, your order has shipped at Amazon.com, but you could really do without the ones from new offers at Amazon.com. In the SpamX website, there's a place where you can blacklist those lame addresses that you don't want to hear from and stop getting those emails, but you can still get the ones you really want, like your order has shipped at Amazon.com. It's really nice to be able to filter them out like that. It doesn't always work perfectly. I've noticed a few sites will keep mutating the address that they're sending the spam from, and if I get that long enough, and it's not a site I use really often, I'll just go ahead and kill it. Like the LA Times, I need to log in there to go turn off my newspaper delivery whenever I'm going out of town, but I don't do it often enough to be worth how much junk mail they send me, so I just shut them off altogether. When I want to get mail back, I can just turn it right back on. Here's the really crazy part of the story. When I first signed up for it, it only cost $9 per year. That's not $9 a month, $9 per year to get no spam. How many of you guys wouldn't pay $9 a year for that? Well, I decided to sign my husband Steve up the other day, and we went in there, and it was free. Now, I don't get this at all, because I've been using these guys for a couple of years. They're definitely a legit outfit. I mean, I don't get any spam. They haven't sold my address. My identity hasn't been compromised or anything weird. They're definitely a legitimate outfit, and yet there's no advertising on this site, and so I don't know why they do it for free, but maybe they make it up in volume. I'm not sure. You should give that a try. I should point out that my home address, my personal address, is actually at mac.com, and I do know they have some terrific spam filters. The reason I know they're part of the solution is because one time I was I checked my mail, and all of a sudden I had 10 or 15 spams, and I thought, oh my gosh, they found me. This is horrible. I lived 2 years, 3 years without spam, but now they found me. Life is over. I'm going to be just like everybody else. And then, boom, all of a sudden they're gone. No more spam. It disappeared. So I think maybe something belched in their spam filters at Mac.com, and then they got them fixed, because now it works like a charm again. So I think you can get a Mac.com address whether you're a PC user, a Mac user, Linux user. I don't think they care, because I think you can should be able to set up your email with them anyway. So I really recommend them. That costs a lot of money, though, to get the Mac.com address. I think it's like $150 or $100 a year or something like that. But you get a bunch of other features. But anyway, the combination of SpamX.com and my Mac.com address both really helped me out quite a bit. So I mentioned last week that I bought my husband a new G5 for Christmas. But I gave it to him early because I can't stand to keep presents for any length of time. No, actually, we got it for him early because we wanted to speed up his DVD encoding. He has encoded all of our DVDs, all of our home movies, our VHS tapes, and converted them all over to DVDs. And now he's doing my friend Diane's movies too. So we wanted to hook him up with a new machine. And I'll give you a little more on how well that's working out in a bit. But I wanted to tell you about a cool thing Apple did in the last few versions of the operating system to make it easy to move from one Mac to another. When I booted up the new G5, it asked me if I was moving from an old Macintosh. I said yes. It told me to hook up the old Mac to the new Mac with a FireWire cable. So this only works if you do have a FireWire old Mac. But it said then to boot up the old Mac while holding down the T key. This puts the old Mac into what's called target disk mode. This means that the old Mac is not booting up into its own operating system, but is simply now a FireWire disk to the new Mac. After the old Mac is in target disk mode, the new Mac transfers over all of the data, all of the applications, and all of the system settings. I know this sounds like magic, and it feels like magic, but it really works. It was amazing when we were finished. The desktop background was there, his email was set up the way he likes it, his address book was there, his network settings were all right, and his applications, with any tweaks he had made to them, were completely in place. It was really a wonderful experience. Leave it to Apple to make it easy. So Steve Burns makes these DVDs, and he makes full two-hour DVDs, encoding full 2 hours of movies complete with elaborate scene selections and music. In iDVD, you can create the scene selections also with, you can have little movies in those and or still pictures, and you can have music that's different for each set of six scene selections you're gonna scan through. So he does a lot of great work on these and makes just really, really beautiful DVDs. On his 1 gigahertz G4, it would take a full 8 hours to encode the DVD. And it has to first encode menus, then it has to encode the DVD. That's the math, the actual processing power of compressing the DVD into the DV format. And then he had a 4x DVD burner, so that would add another half hour to actually burn the DVD. So his total time was 8.5 hours to burn a 2 hour DVD. With his new dual-core 2 GHz G5, the total elapsed time to encode and burn the DVD was only 2 hours and 31 minutes. I'm really, really happy about it. I knew it was going to be faster, but I looked everywhere on the web for somebody doing any kind of metrics of the exact same thing done on a 2 GHz on a G5 versus a G4, and I couldn't find anybody who's got metrics on it. I knew that it would be faster because the processor, first of all, is twice the clock speed. So it went from 1 gigahertz to 2 gigahertz. That's got to have cut it in half right there. But the fact that it's a G5 instead of a G4 should have sped it up some, not double, but it should have done some speed improvement because the G5 is more efficient than the G4. And then having the G5 be dual core is where it has two processors on one chip. So it's sort of like a dual processor, but supposedly even faster than that. I knew that would be an advantage, but I wasn't sure how much the DVD encoding would take advantage of that second processor. If it really is multi-threaded and splits the process between the two processors, it could speed it up a lot, but it was hard to tell how much it would actually do that. The 16x burner cut another 22 minutes off the time, going from 4x to 16x, but the real killer was that raw processing time for the encoding process. So Steve is really, really happy with his new machine, and our goals have been achieved. Really, really happy with the new machine. It was a good buy for right now. Well, it's time for our movie review. This Friday night, we watched Bewitched. It's acted with Will Ferrell and Nicole Kidman. I was a big fan of Bewitched as a child, and this was a real nice remake. It's not an epic film that'll leave you talking about it for days, debating what did that meaningful ending mean, what big effect it had on your life. But it's a nice bit of comedy if you like Will Ferrell. Several times we caught him slipping into his imitations of people like James Lipton of Inside the Actor's Studio. At first we thought that was a mistake, but then in the next scene there was Will Ferrell being interviewed by James Lipton. That was pretty funny. Nicole Kidman was okay. She doesn't really do it for me. I mean, she's fine, nothing wrong with her or anything, but she wasn't a big part of the movie in my opinion. But Shirley MacLaine played Endora, Samantha's mother, and she was just really, really good as that part. And Michael Caine played Nigel Bigelow, Samantha's father, and just really well cast in those roles. They just fit. But the best casting in the whole movie, I think, was Steve Carroll, the guy, he's the lead in the TV show The Office, or might have remembered him in Bruce Almighty. He was a guy that had his lips moving all funny in that one, and I think he's in 40-Year-Old Virgin, too. Anyway, he was cast as Uncle Arthur, and he was just perfect. I mean, he had the laugh right, he had the annoying acting just perfectly. It really came off well. I forget who played Aunt Clara, but she did a great job, too. In fact, when we first saw her, we thought it actually was Aunt Clara. So anyway, that was it was an enjoyable way to spend $3 on a rental if you're a big fan of the series, but I wouldn't recommend buying it. If you haven't seen The Old Bewitched, I'm not sure it would really be that great of a movie. It was just kind of a fun little walk down memory lane. Well, here's a little site that I think is a lot of fun, think you might get a kick out of. It's called The Baby Name Wizard. It's hosted at babynamewizard.com. This cool little tool shows you all the names that have been used since the 1880s in a serape chart. That's a chart that shows all the names stacked on top of each other to show you the popularity of each name as a function of time. And you can hover your cursor over the chart, and let's say you find a fat part in the chart, and you're thinking, man, I wonder what name was popular during that year. The name will pop up to show you which one you're over, and you can see, as a function of time, which ones were popular. The color chart is also color-coded by pink and blue to show you boys' and girls' names all on the same chart. That's pretty interesting, but the fun comes in when you can, because you can type in a particular name into the site. The graph mutates into a chart of just that name's popularity over time. It shows you as a function of the number per million babies born in that year. If you pick a name that could be a boy or a girl, like Jean, for example, it'll show both of them on there in pink and blue. So you get this graph that shows you how popular the name was, which is kind of fun. I put in Alice, and of course that's what everybody does. You go in and you put in your own name, because we're all narcissists, aren't we? So I put in Allison, and it shows that it didn't come into usage as a girl's name until the 1930s. And I'm pretty sure that's right around, well, I'm not sure what time Peyton Place came out. That's when I think my mother first heard the name. But it peaked out in, with 1,900 girls per million were named Allison in the 1990s, sorry, when it became the 41st most popular name. Here's a fun fact. It was a boy's name from the 1880s through the 1920s, with about 50 boys per million being named Allison. Check out the Baby Name Wizard. You'll have lots of fun playing with it. Well, it looks like that wraps up show number 15 of the NoSillaCast podcast. Hope you've enjoyed the show tonight, and I hope you'll drop me some feedback at allison@podfeed.com. I still don't get very much feedback, and I'd love to hear from anyone anywhere across the globe. Stay subscribed!